This is the Hudson Mohawk Magazine on WOOC 105.3 FM, broadcasting from the Sanctuary of Independent Media in Troy, New York. I'm Mark Russo.
And I'm Tatiana Morani. In this show, we'll be featuring an interview with David King, editor of The Alt. The Alt is a weekly free newsletter that features news, current events, and things to do in the Capital Region.
Then, Assemblymember Charles Barron interrupted Governor Andrew Cuomo at last week's state budget presentation. Mark Dunley was on the scene.
Afterwards, WOOC correspondent Mark Dunley reports from the Northeast Organic Farming Association's annual conference this weekend in Saratoga Springs. He sat down with policy chairperson Lee Anna Hoods to discuss the statewide organization's policy objectives for 2018.
And later on, we'll have Stanley Hadzel from Market Block Books on to give us some reviews on the latest and greatest in the book scene. Let's start off the show with some rapid-fire headlines.
The Times Union reports that the Troy City Council and the State Attorney General's Office will meet to discuss the report on the fatal police shooting of a DWI suspect that recommended reforms for the Troy Police Department to implement regarding officer-involved shootings. The meeting was requested by City Council President Carmela Montello. The report condemned the Troy Police and Rensselaer County District Attorney Joel Abelove's investigation and the death of Edison Thevenin, who was fatally shot by Sergeant Randall French during the April 2016 DWI traffic stop. Mayor Patrick Madden's claim that the report contains factual errors and his refusal to for the council to review the Police Oversight Review Board, which has not met in about 2 years. Community activists have called for the city to create a civilian review board with subpoena and investigatory powers.
The Troy Record reports that several prominent alumni of RPI have released a new plan urging the college to re-examine the progress made under the leadership of RPI President Shirley Jackson over the last 18 years. They claim that the existing plan to focus on more research to improve the school has failed to achieve its stated objectives and instead resulted in a debt-ridden school with a disappointing endowment, declining rankings among its peers, and a college campus they describe as a culture of fear. The group, which says it has the support of several hundred alumni, says that overtures to the Board of Trustees have been ignored. Renew Rensselaer was born out of what is now a two-year-plus battle over control of the Rensselaer Union, which has been student-run since its founding in 1891.
Newsday is reporting that New York State taxpayers have paid more than $10 million over the last 9 years to settle 88 cases of sexual harassment, discrimination, and related cases in state government, almost all of which were brought by women reporting groping, come-ons, and degrading treatment. 15 cases among the settlements were against the Department of Corrections and resulted in more than $2.5 million in settlements. While two of the cases involved the state legislature, most involved workers in prisons, colleagues, hospitals, and in other state workplaces.
A coalition of progressive groups sent a letter calling on Governor Cuomo to cancel all state permits for the CPV natural gas power plant that is central to the trial of Joseph Prococo, the governor's longtime friend and formal aide. The trial started Monday. Competitive Power Ventures is accused by federal prosecutors of bribing Prococo and giving his wife a no-show job. The groups also called on the governor to return the millions of dollars of donations he's received from real estate companies for his election campaign, much of that coming from the so-called LLC loophole that Cuomo claims he wants to close.
Gun violence in New York costs $5.6 billion a year, according to a group funded by former Arizona Representative Gabriel Giffords. Using data from the Centers for Disease Control, Giffords group found that New York annually averages 432 gun-related homicides, 1,499 non-fatal shootings, and 105 accidental shootings. Giffords Law Center found in excess of $2.1 billion in direct costs, including $106 million per year on health care, $203 million for law enforcement and criminal justice expenses, $12 million in cost to employers, and $1.7 billion in lost income. Up to 85% of gunshot victims are either uninsured or on some form of publicly funded insurance.
The Glen Falls Post Star reports that the U.S. Senator Chuck Schumer on Friday formally asked federal regulators to halt Saratoga and North Creek Railway from bringing more railroad tanker cars to the Adirondacks to be stored on the former Tahnawis rail line. Schumer said storing obsolete tank cars in the Adirondacks is a serious environmental hazard, and he called on the U.S. Surface Transportation Board to intervene. The corporate owner of at least some of the train cars brought to the line indicated it plans to remove them, but SNCR has said it has other rail car owners looking for storage space. The railroad has asked the state to compensate it for the revenue it would lose. For those of you just joining us, this is WOOC 105.3, Troy, New York.
To learn more about this program and how you can support the Sanctuary for Independent Media, visit us online at mediasanctuary.org. For our first segment, WOOC correspondent Aaron Padinati speaks with David King, editor of The Alt.
I'm Aaron Padinati, and today I'm interviewing David Howard King about local and alternative news production in the Capital Region. David is the editor and associate publisher of the Capital Region's new alternative news weekly, The Alt. He spent 7 years covering state government from a New York City perspective for the Gotham Gaze. In 2012, he served as the state reporter for the Center for Public Integrity's State Integrity Investigation that was backed by Public Radio International. He's the winner of multiple New York Press Association awards, including Writer of the Year 2007 and Feature of the Year. He started his journalism career through an internship at Metroland, Albany's now defunct Alt Weekly. He was hired there later that year, and that was a fitting start to his career since the Alt has filled the gap left by the demise of Metroland, coming to serve as the leading weekly source of alternative news for the Tri-City area. David, thanks for taking the time to talk with me today. It's good to have you here.
Thanks for having me.
To start out, I want to ask about the fall of Metroland. I was living away from the Capital Region when it went under, but when I got back and found out it was no longer in publication, I remember feeling a mix of surprise and regret over the fact that an alternative news source that had seemed like a fixture or even kind of an institution of the Capital Region was no longer with us. What happened there?
To be honest, when I was a kid, I looked up to Metroland. It was a source for me to find what to do every week and learn about different things that I wouldn't in the larger publications. When I first started interning there in college and then afterwards, I quickly learned that it was in turmoil. And week to week, it was a publication that you would wonder what was going to happen. You know, were you going to get paid that week? Were freelancers going to write because they weren't paid? I mean, it was struggling, and obviously it was going on in the middle of the prevalence of internet news and blogging and things like that. I don't think it adapted one to new technology and the way consumers. Or people, the way people consume news. And I also think it had a problem with diversity and covering topics that mattered to real people and coming from more of an open and diverse perspective rather than sort of being just a bastion of Lark Street and sort of middle-of-the-road democratic politics.
Okay. So that's the sad story from the past. Now let's turn to the happier story from the present. Can you tell us a bit about the Alt? What is it and what does it do?
Well, before I even got involved, I had heard about Overit, which is a local multimedia company, the Daily Gazette, which obviously the Schenectady paper, and Proctor's, which the Proctor's Theater, which has its hand in obviously a lot of entertainment in the region, Capital Rep and things like that, that all these people were going to get together and sort of try to save and or replace Metroland. And I was skeptical of it at first because Metroland had a hard go of it. And some of their messaging on what they wanted to achieve wasn't what I thought was exactly possible or needed in the area. But I did know a lot of the people involved, and they're people that really care. They're deeply involved in the community. And so when I interviewed for the position, I was frank in what I thought was needed and in the region, and they agreed with me and gave me the ability to really implement my vision. And, of course, it grows day to day. But, I think what we really want to do is serve the community by highlighting local arts and create the creative economy. And provide journalism that the mainstream media isn't, and really keeping the public informed. There's no place really needs it more, in my opinion, than Albany, with so many institutions that are just old and set in their ways and run by the establishment. And all of our journalism sources in the area are connected to government in some way. They rely on the government they cover for money. And I think that, you know, there needs to be independence here. Obviously, what you guys do here is extremely important as well in giving people a voice. And so that's what we're striving to do.
Can you tell us a bit about the effort that goes into putting an alternative news publication together on a weekly basis? What's the timeline for selecting, submitting, and editing stories?
So our week basically starts on Tuesday when we have an editorial meeting. It's me, Katie Cusack, our news editor, and Luke Stoddard-Nathan, our news editor. And we have a set of freelancers that sometime work, and we have our meeting. We pick stories. We look through the major things that are in the works already. And, you know, the struggle for an alt-weekly that's trying to put out news daily is that we want to do these long investigative pieces that need a lot of research. And we also want to make sure that we're getting scoops and keeping people informed on the things that really impact their lives. So there's a lot of balance that goes on there. But by Friday, we have a wrap on most of the stories we knew were going to be in the paper. And then on Monday, we sort of lock ourselves in the basement and put out the paper. We do the production in-house. We do the design in-house. So it's all very handmade. And it takes, by the end of Monday, we're all ready to go to bed for a long time. But right. it's worth it.
So along those lines, how do your editorial staff and writers make decisions about what kind of stories to pursue in the first place, and what kinds of priorities about newsworthiness affect your decisions in this regard?
Well, I think a lot of what we look at, in terms of, say, arts and music, we look at sort of the creative economy and how people can help each other sort of bridge the, you know, there's a parochialism in the area between Albany and Troy and Schenectady and Saratoga. So bringing that all together, highlighting the people that deserve it, we look at what isn't being covered but deserves it to do. We look for trends. So that's sort of arts coverage. But news coverage, there are distinct ways that the establishment media here covers certain stories. And we look to subvert that in a lot of ways. And we look to get involved in stories that perhaps they don't want to touch or are uncomfortable for them. I think, say, for one, to give an example of a story that I think has been covered poorly in the area, but and we're still working on, is sort of the Me Too movement and sexual harassment in the media or politics, or I'm sorry, you know, in government. And we're working on a number of stories, and perhaps local mainstream media are too, but we haven't seen them yet, and we know that there's a lot of this institutionalized, and it's a touchy subject, and it'll offend a lot of people once these stories hit. But we're working on them because I think it's a service to the region. It'll better our community to have these issues discussed.
Mm-hmm. And in terms of other stories that might deserve some attention but haven't gotten their due, anything in local politics or scandals, extreme local controversies, things like that?
Well, I think we're seeing. I mean, obviously, we're sitting here in Troy where you have a DA who's been indicted for this handling of a police shooting of a citizen. There's a quadruple murder that the police have had trouble prosecuting already. There's a distinct lack of trust in the police. And to pretend it's a unique situation for sure, but to pretend the atmosphere is unique is absurd, because in Schenectady you have one of the most corrupt police departments we've seen. And that's not saying they're not working on making it better, but to think that we're in this situation in Troy in 2018 with institutionalized racism, with police, we've seen them cut corners on a number of cases, drug raids that interrupt communities. We're miles away from the state capitol where they preach about fixing this sort of stuff. And yet we see this stuff flare up all the time. And as advanced and sort of progressive as we want to pretend that Albany and Troy might be, we're living in these systems that are inherently corrupt and flawed.
Okay, so for the last question, can you give a sense of the significance of local, independent, alternative news? What are the unique challenges and rewards of producing news in this way? Why is it important, and why is it something that you care about?
Well, one of the major challenges we've run into is that, you know, I think to be truly effective, we have to offend some people. We have to tell stories that people didn't want told or are going to be particularly sensitive about how we tell them. And it's something we have to absorb. We have to be ready to deal with. My last job for 7 years was at a not-for-profit, so I didn't have to worry about who I was offending or what was, you know, to some extent. But I don't worry about it here, but I hear about it. And I didn't used to hear about it because, you know, you see an advertiser who's offended and you think, what happened? And that's not to, you know, like I said, we don't take it into account. We want to press buttons, and I think that's where we make our bones. But it is challenging because the other alternatives, like blogs and other local things that do this sort of coverage or try to make sure they don't insult anyone, and they run press releases daily, and they do very tame coverage, and they don't push, because if you push, you lose advertisers and you get backlash. And so I think it's our duty and, you know, a duty as journalists to question authority, to push elected officials, to question the way systems work and have for years. And, to, you know, you have to make people angry. There's no way around it.
Okay, so that actually raised one last question, and I'm going to add to my questions. The issue of funding in the face of willing to be controversial. So you are willing to do things that other publications aren't willing to do around here, and there's a chance that that can offend people in some ways that may not be necessarily good for a mainstream commercial funding supply. So how do you get around that? What's your funding model?
Well, I mean, you know, we are straight advertising. That's how we make our money. And, you know, we've talked about the idea that we could do nonprofit journalism. And you see The Guardian and sources like that asking for donations, but we haven't and we don't plan to. What we say to our advertisers is, look, people have to read us because we make these stories. And even say an advertiser that says, oh, you're not covering you're not covering the big mainstream shows, you're covering too much underground stuff. Well, the kids that go to those underground shows pick it up every week. And if you want to get them to your shows, you're going to need to reach them through our. And it's tricky. It's not easy, but I think it's really worth doing.
So it's kind of like being honest with the advertisers about the fact that you're going to be controversial.
Yeah. I mean, they see it every week. Can't hide it.
Right. Well, David, thanks again for sitting down for this interview. It's a pleasure talking to you.
Thanks so much for having me. It's a pleasure.
And to our listening audience, please be sure to tune in at the same time next week for another interview with David about the State Integrity Investigation of 2012.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine on WOOC 105.3 FM.
That was WOOC correspondent Aaron Pidnati speaking with David King, editor of the Alt Magazine. Now on to our next segment. Last weekend, the Northeast Organic Farming Association held its annual statewide conference in Saratoga Springs. WOOC correspondent Mark Dungley sat down with NOFA policy chairperson Leanna Hoetz to discuss their policy objectives for 2018, including the upcoming federal farm bill.
We're at the Saratoga statewide conference with the Northeast Organic Farm Association. And we're talking with Leanna Hoetz, who helps with the policy for NOFA. Leanna, what are some of the key policy issues that NOFA is dealing with? You mentioned before the issue of certification. What does that mean?
NOFA New York is an accredited certifier for the USDA's organic certification program, and we've always believed that strong standards with high integrity for organic keep family farmers profitable and in the game of organic. So we're really concerned at the national level that organic standards are being watered down and that the Department of Agriculture is not implementing or enforcing the organic law properly.
Now, one of the issues that have been raised over the years is how costly it can be for, say, smaller farmers to comply with some of these organic, federal regulations. Has that issue been addressed?
Indeed. We hear it a lot that it's expensive to certify to organic, but the truth of the matter is it is not that expensive. There, a small vegetable farm typically could be about $350 to certify, and then there's a USDA program that's been in existence since the beginning of certification that returns 75% of that back to the farmer. So the cost is not that high, and the benefit and the added value on your retail price is definitely proven.
Now, one of the issues that's been raised over the years is just the cost for a new farmer to get into the agriculture, you know, business if they're not from a family which already is in agriculture. Are there programs out there to help, you know, young farmers get started?
Indeed, there are increasingly programs for new beginning farmers, young farmers coming in. They have a lot of upfront costs from all of the infrastructure, but they also have a lot of difficulty accessing the land. Price of land, for instance, in the Hudson Valley is just exorbitant. So we need to put in place more programs to help young farmers have access to owning the land so they can build the equity in their business.
Now, if there's a consumer out there and, you know, they go to the local grocery store and, you know, organic's about a buck more for a pepper, what are the benefits to the consumer of shopping organic for their food?
Organic food is grown in general in as close to natural systems as possible, and specifically, organic food is not grown with toxic pesticides or herbicides. So the food itself doesn't have a pesticide load, and that's been proven. In addition, the organic practices are really good for the environment. Organic soils both protect from drought as well as floods, and altogether, organic is about being better for the environment and better for the health of people.
Now, the major bill which shapes our food system in the United States is the Farm Bill. A lot of the funding actually goes towards the anti-hunger program, but there's always been complaints over the year that too much of the funding goes to corporate agriculture, to promoting monocrops, and to subsidizing things like corn and soy, which are not necessarily healthy because of too high fat, too high sugar. What are some of the goals with the organic community in terms of the Farm Bill, and are you optimistic that you'll see action on that?
Well, optimism about the Farm Bill is difficult. We'll see if Congress can actually get to it. What we do see is an increasing interest in organic agriculture because the organic marketplace has been growing so fast. There are a couple of areas that need some significant attention, such as organic research. Right now, about 2-3% of all USDA research dollars are spent on organic research. That's pathetic, and it has an effect on our farmers not having the tools they need to do better and better at organic. And in addition, organic research is the results of organic research is available to all farmers, and it would help all farmers come up with tools that are not based in toxic materials.
Now, one of the workshops at the conference this weekend up in Saratoga was the issue of how we deal with climate change in agriculture. Certainly a lot of people point to the concept of regenerative agriculture, trying to put carbon back into the soil, make it more fertile. What is sort of regenerative agriculture, and how big is that in terms of a movement becoming?
It's a huge movement, growing huge movement. It's not about a label per se, as organic is, and it's about the idea that agriculture actually builds on its practices and builds the soil and regenerates the soil continually. And what that does for instance, climate change is make it have the ability to sequester carbon in a big way.
Now, if any of our listeners are out there thinking about, yeah, I should start growing organic in my garden, but I've always been worried about how to deal with this particular pest. Are there information on, say, the NOFA website that can help them?
Absolutely. The NOFA website has a lot of different tools for gardeners as well as farmers. That's nofany.org. I would also look at the Rodale Institute website, and the website of the Organic Farming Research Foundation. There are actually a lot of websites out there giving you some tools, but there are lots of ways to do it. You don't need to use toxic chemicals in your backyard.
And maybe a two-part question we'll end up with. One is just, you know, what is the NOFA website? People want more information, or how do they get you know, active with NOFR at the local level? And then just second, are there any other state or national policies that NOFR is pushing that you'd like people to be aware of?
Sure. We NOFA New York, www.nofany.org, is a really great tool to use. It not only has these techniques to help you with your gardening, but they sign up for our policy committee, and we'll send you action alerts on what you can do statewide and nationally to support organic farming. And we encourage people to start learning about policy in their own backyard.
And we've been talking with Leanna Hoods, and this is Mark Dunley. Leanna is with Northeast Organic Farm Association, and I'm with WOOC.
If you're just tuning in, that was Leanna Hoods discussing NOFA's policy objectives for 2018. But I think, actually, my co-host, Mark Russo, didn't you also go to that conference?
I did, and so did Dave Pablo, who's another host for the Hudson Mohawk Magazine.
So we were just in there representing, huh? Yep. So tell me about the conference. Like, how was your experience there?
I had a really wonderful time. I've been involved with the organic farming scene in this area for about 5 years, and I haven't been to a NOFA conference in 4 years. So it was really wonderful to go and reconnect with people and also to see all the different shades of people who are involved in organic farming. There are a lot of people you might imagine look like organic farmers, but there are also a lot of young farmers, young people who are getting involved in agriculture. And just an enormous number of workshops covering everything from homestead, backyard level things to tree crops, animals, vegetables, minerals too, because they talk about things you can add to your soil to build fertility, policy.
How was the conference different this time you went versus when you went 4 years ago?
You know, it's hard to say because I'm a very different person now than I was then. But I would say the workshops have definitely evolved over time. Now they are much more focused, and they follow they're set up so you can follow a specific track. So say you're interested in grains, like Amy Halloran might be, you could follow that track all throughout the conference and get a really intensive look at grains. They also had a test kitchen open this year where they taught people about fermenting vegetables, doing stocks and broths, and also cooking with local produce.
That's actually really, really cool. It kind of makes me want to go next year.
I highly recommend it. It's right up in Saratoga Springs, so it's very easily accessible. It's in the Saratoga City Center. They do offer scholarships for organic growers and farmers and people who are interested in the field. That I think the due date for application will be next December, so you have some time to apply, or you can apply for you can volunteer as well to help out. You can do everything from registering people to check mm-hmm. badges at dinner. And this may not apply to so many listeners, but there's a huge trade show that happens there too, where there's seed producers, there's educators from different programs in the region from Vermont and New York that have farming related education programs. There were some local there was a wool manufacturer. She had gloves and blankets and all kinds of things.
So from, there really is a lot of different type of stuff. That's really cool. Very interesting.
It's there's a lot of breadth and depth in organic farming, and it's really right in our backyard. So it's really worth it to make the trip.
For sure. Well, thanks for giving us a little, 411 rundown.
You're
about
welcome.
That.
There'll be more to come because Dave and I will be putting up a lot of content that we recorded at the conference at the farm segment that usually airs on Friday.
Oh, okay, cool. Awesome. Well, listeners, if you're just tuning in, I'm Tatiana Morani.
And I'm Mark Russo. You're listening to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine on WOOC 105.3 FM, Troy.
To learn more about the Hudson Mohawk Magazine program, to listen online, and to learn how to support the Sanctuary for Independent Media, check us out online at mediasanctuary.org.
Assemblymember Charles Barron of Brooklyn has made a habit to interrupt Governor Cuomo during his speeches. Barron did it last Thursday during the governor's budget presentation, challenging his statement on education, Last Tuesday, during the governor's budget presentation, challenging his statement on education funding and the overall funding for anti-poverty and housing programs, WOOC's Mark Dunley reports.
With WOOC, and I'm talking with Assemblymember Charles Barron, who had a little bit of a disagreement today with Governor Cuomo during his budget presentation over whether or not the increase in funding was adequate. So, Assemblymember, what was the point you're trying to make in terms of the funding being provided for education?
They owe us meaning the black and brown children in poor, struggling schools in New York City and across the state, $4.2 billion to satisfy the campaign for fiscal equity debt that the state courts said because of the racist allocation of funding in education, they owe that to these schools. He has yet to pay that debt. Every year he ignores it or puts some minor, small amount toward it. So when he was presenting his education piece, I didn't see the campaign for fiscal equity money. That is separate from him saying this is a historical record amount of money spent for education. Don't believe the hype. Don't be bamboozled and took by that language, because every year, because of the raise of inflation, education money is going to be record. In 1991, it was about $11 billion. 92, it was 12. 90, you know, went up each year. It was a record because of inflation and the cost. His raise in the education money doesn't even match the cost for education, much less the campaign for fiscal equity money. He is not being truthful and honest. These budgets in his state of the state are usually times where they're PR messages for him and not dealing with the truth and the facts of the budget.
We recently observed the 50th anniversary of Dr. King's both March on Washington, but particularly the Poor People's Campaign, and yet 50 years later, it seems like segregation in education and housing has increased. You know, what are some of the concerns about housing that you're seeing?
Very good question, because I was really upset that here it is Martin Luther King's birthday, and Martin Luther King said, silence is betrayal. Martin Luther King in 1968 lost his life organizing a poor people's campaign. Where is there any money in this budget for poverty, to deal with poverty? That's what Dr. King was about in his last year. That's what the poor people's campaign was about. When I first came up here, I raised poverty campaign for fiscal equity. He put $10 million out of $150 billion plus budget into poverty in the Bronx because some politicians he was trying to satisfy. The next year we raised poverty, he puts $25 million in poverty for people upstate. So there was zero money in there for poverty. Housing, we have too much homelessness in New York State, all across the state, and probably the richest state in the United States, barring California probably and Texas. But they got more money here, the $85 billion city budget and the $150-60+ billion state budget. You're talking about $230-240 billion. Nobody should be homeless. But there's no money in to deal with homelessness and a real affordable house, and not this nonsense that Bill de Blasio talks about, who I call a pseudo-progressive, because he's not really talking about real affordability for the people who live in those areas. So there's nothing in there for housing that we can be proud of, and health is going to take a hit, and he refuses to tax the millionaires, saying they've been hit enough from the feds. The ones he's going to tax and try to get something from are the millionaires that own corporations, because they get a 40% break from the feds. But the millionaires who don't own corporations, they don't get a 40% break, so they want to leave them alone and then try to raise revenue some other kinds of way. We need a commuter tax back, we need a stock transfer tax, and we need to tax the capital gains on the millionaires. They don't have a payroll.
Well, you know, the governor talked about a $4 billion deficit, $1 billion of revenue enhancements you talked about. Half of that seemed to be from the conversion of nonprofit insurance companies, which is not always in the best interest of people. You mentioned sort of the tax on wealthy. How do you think the legislature will look at trying to deal with this revenue shortfall?
Yeah, I think we have to look at the way we looked at it when they had a $10 billion deficit years ago. You have to raise money on the rich. Those who have more must pay more. Bottom line. And you have to use the money from last year. There's about $2 billion rolled over from last year. That cuts the deficit in half right away. They're gonna close this deficit easily. But they use the deficit to say, hey, we're in tight times, so you're not going to be able to get this for campaign for fiscal equity. You're not going to be able to get this for affordable housing because we have a deficit. We have a deficit. That is bogus. That is bogus. The bottom line is whatever this budget is now, 155, 160, deficit or surplus, $150 billion plus is going to be spent. So it's about the prioritization of spending. Not deficits and surplus, because even when we have surpluses, we still don't get the campaign for fiscal equity money, and we still don't get money for poverty, and we still don't get money for real affordable housing. So don't talk to me about no deficit, because it's bogus.
Well, speaking of affordable housing, I know the last couple of years, Assemblymember Hevesy's had this proposal to get about 80% of the average housing cost as sort of a housing subsidy. Don't think that made it into the governor's proposal. Is the Hevesy approach adequate?
Absolutely. I support it 1,000%. Why isn't it in the budget? Why isn't it in his legislative package? That would resolve a lot of our problems around affordable housing and dealing with the housing issue. But they won't even deal with that. Why? Why? These are the kinds of contradictions and hypocrisies that this government espouses during Martin Luther King Jr.'s birthday celebration.
One of the other issues I'm a little bit surprised about, of course, the New York City subway has been quite a bit of a crisis. New York Times did a series saying we need about $110 billion to sort of fix it. And then I think the governor's proposing an extra $400 million, not billion. And that seemed a little bit small given the extent of the problem.
Exactly, because he's running for office, high office, and he wants to give the perception of handling problems when the money is not there. And the other thing is that we got to look at the MTA before giving them more money. They have cookbooks, they have double sets of books, they're mismanaging money. So just throwing a lot of money at the MTA is a concern. But this governor, when you talk about $400 million in a state that has a multi-billion dollar capital budget, it's absurd.
Now, one of the things that confuses a lot of us is this idea that the way to deal with the pretty bad federal tax cuts is to transform the New York State income tax into a payroll tax. Do you understand what he's trying to do there? Does that make sense?
Yeah. Well, I understand what he's trying to do, but that's not the answer. What he's trying to do is to reduce your amount of taxable income to the feds since they're not letting you write off the state deduction anymore. So if you make $100, as he showed, and $5 of that was going to the feds, state tax, then they're not allowing you to deduct that $5. So what he's saying, you have your $100, but you'll only be showing $95 to the feds. So even though they didn't let you deduct the $5, through this payroll arrangement, you'll be able to still not have to, you know, you don't lose that $5. You'll still be able to deduct that $5 on a state level. That's like peanuts compared to what needs to really happen. What really needs to happen is that we need to tax the millionaires to get the revenue. We need to make sure if they're cutting Medicare and other health kinds of things on a federal level, we need to increase it on a state level. Healthcare is getting hit horribly. Mm-hmm. And his answer for that is really inadequate to be kind. It's inadequate.
Well, a report came out today that the percentage of Americans, adults, who are lacking health insurance increased by 1.3% over the last year. And that was even before we had all the federal, tax cuts. What are some of the things you would like to see done in healthcare?
I would like to see a universal single-payer healthcare system, a bill that Dick Gottfried, our chair of the health committee, we passed in as a single bill here in the state assembly. The way you pay for it is through the capital gains tax and the progressive payroll tax. I'm not crazy about a progressive payroll tax, but that's how Dick proposes to pay for it. Then it'll be Medicare for all, free health care, like they have in those countries they hate, like Cuba and Venezuela and some poor African nations, Angola. They have free health care. And then and public free health care in Canada and England. Why not the richest country in the world with a $4+ trillion budget, a $150-60 billion state budget, a $85 billion city budget? You can't provide free health education and free health care like some of these developing countries could do, but this is a highly developed, highly technologized country with a just a tremendous amount of capital, and you can't provide free health care and free education. That is a sin before God.
So we've been talking with Assemblymember Charles Barron from Brooklyn. One last question. What didn't we ask you about that you would like to tell our listeners about in terms of some of your concerns and priorities?
Well, first of all, the main thing is we need a multi-billion dollar poverty program to fight poverty. That cannot come at a better time than now, because our people are dying, they're hurting, we're in a state of crises. There's nothing in this governor's budget, nothing in the mayor's budget that speaks to poverty in black and brown communities. That has to be the number one issue, and it cannot come at a better time than Martin Luther King's birthday, when he died in his last years on earth building the Poor People's Campaign.
Thank you, Assemblymember Barron, and this has been Mark Dunley for WOOC.
That was Assemblymember Charles Barron discussing the state budget with WOOC correspondent Mark Dunley.
Next to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine, we welcome our longtime friend, Stanley Hatzel from Market Block Books. How are you, Stanley?
I am well, thank you.
Good to have you. So, if you are a loyal WOOC watcher, or rather listener, then you know Stanley brings us books every week. So what books do you have this week, Stanley?
Well, I brought you a few books this time instead of a large stack of books, and two books of poetry and one book of life-changing magic, but not tidying up. But I want to start a conversation about reading life and books that I don't think people really know or talk about very often. And I get insights to customers all the time at the store where they'll tell me something about what they're reading or what they like and what they don't like. And in the process over, I've been doing this for 19 years for this store, it's just amazing to see what people are willing to say and open up their hearts. And as a result, they change me. My book tastes have changed because of the customers. So I wanted to, you know, talk about that dynamic and not just tell you about the latest and the hottest new book right now. So that's a piece of what I want to talk about. But I also want to read you some lovely poetry from some amazing people and start the ball rolling with that conversation. So for instance, I was mentioning earlier that I usually wake up every morning and after a certain amount of time, I read Moby Dick. That's the thing I'm into right now. And I get on that boat and I'm out to sea as soon as I open those pages. And I have read Moby Dick before, but never with this sense of connectedness that I have right now. And there's such a joy for that. And I've mentioned that to a few customers and a few other people who roll their eyes and say, it's not that good, is it, really? Or
I think whenever people suggest the classic that like Moby Dick, people feel like they kind of get it already, even if they haven't already read it. You know,
right.
It's like you get the point, but I think you have a good point. I think there's definitely something different with hearing about it from other people and reading it for yourself with this different mindset.
And there's also, for me, the experience of reading a book later on after having maybe read it before, or there's something going on in my life right now that I'm more open to whatever Moby Dick is willing to tell me today.
I guess for a lot of people, I would imagine people think, well, with an old book, what could an old book have to teach us in
right.
the 21st century? Or like a 2020, like a whaling book from the 1800s?
Well, that is the $10,000 question. and I will say, and I pointed this out before, that excuse me, that Philip Nathaniel Philbrick wrote a book called Why Read Moby Dick, and he talks about the enduring legacy of this novel. And when you read it, there are things that feel relevant to life today. I mean, just you read about Ahab, and you know people who are just like Ahab, either personally or publicly. So it's not just Moby Dick. The other thing I'm doing in the evenings is I'm reading Shakespeare, The Winter's Tale. I'm the Troy Public Library has a Shakespeare class, and you can participate. And we read the plays are always five acts long, so every week we do a different act. And that has just shifted my awareness of language. And you would think Shakespeare is, you know, hundreds of years old, that, you know, what relevancy is there? But this guy knew human psychology. You know, look at King Lear, or look at Hamlet, and you see all these flaws that you probably can see in yourself, in your neighbors, in your whoever. There's amazing riches in these books.
I'm always amazed when I read Shakespeare about how many expressions were developed that he created.
Yeah.
That come from Shakespeare's books. I haven't read much of it since college, but in reading through, I was just amazed by, like, this expression or that thing that's actually 400 years old and Shakespeare came up with it. And now it's something we still use all the time.
Yes, more quoted sometimes than the Bible, Shakespeare is. and often people think those quotes are from the Bible when they're actually from Shakespeare himself.
You said you had poems for us.
So I have some poems because I think I'm really a romantic at heart, and I think really life is poetry. So this book is called Conflict Resolution for Holy Beings by Joy Harjo. She's an indigenous poet out of Oklahoma, and this one came out in 2015, and this is my advanced reader copy, so it's a little bit worn, and there's some, embarrassed to say, a couple of coffee stains in here. But this is... Oh, there's the stain right on the poem. It's called This Morning I Pray for My Enemies. And she says, "And whom do I call my enemy? An enemy must be worthy of engagement. I turn in the direction of the sun and keep walking. It's the heart that asks the questions, not my furious mind. The heart is the smaller cousin of the sun. It sees and knows everything. It hears the gnashing even as it hears the blessing. The door to the mind should only open from the heart. An enemy who gets in risks the danger of becoming a friend." And I love her saying that the heart is the smaller cousin of the sun. And that if you get into my heart, you risk becoming my friend.
Yeah. It kind of makes me think of a time where I was angry with somebody, and eventually I was, like, not angry with them anymore, and I wanted to be angry at them. You ever forced yourself to be upset, or...
Yes.
Like, just held on to that grudge, even though you really don't care anymore, but you just feel like maybe... I don't know, like, it's important to be angry or something.
You're not ready to let go of it.
Yeah, it's like, this needs to happen. Like, I need to be angry, and it's just the appropriate feeling right now. And so you fight not being angry anymore. I find myself doing that a lot, and that's kind of what comes to mind when I hear you read that.
I think this poem kind of brings to mind that state, the phrase, like, bring your friends close and keep your enemies closer.
Yeah.
In many ways, when you're engaged in somebody in a negative way, you can be more, think about them more and be more obsessed with their behavior and the way that they affect your life than the people that you love.
Exactly.
It can be problematic. So what other poems did you bring for us today?
So this is David Budbill's book, Moment to Moment. He passed away a year ago, or last year, I think. And he lived a life of the similar to the Chinese mountain recluses. So he would lived up on a mountain. He did all of his own chopping his wood. He'd go out and be alone a lot. And so he writes these very simple and elegant poems.
Who are the Chinese
Recluses. These are ancient, probably 3rd, 4th century in China, these ancient wise guys who would hang out in the mountains, write poetry, and just meditate.
So perhaps like European tradition of a hermit, but the...
Way even before that, though, yes. Probably even before any Christian tradition happened. So that's what he's emulating. Although he does tie this into some Buddhist context as well, but although Buddhism predates Christianity by another 500 years. So this one is called the title is almost longer than the poem, okay? How and why you should be circumspect about your inner life. How and why you should be circumspect about your inner life, he says. Try not to look like you're on the path to somewhere. That way, nobody will ask where you're going.
That's my method all the time.
Try not to look like you're on a path to somewhere. That way, nobody will ask where you're going.
That's kind of opposite to the advice you have as a New York City person, where you always need to look like you're going somewhere so that nobody asks you anything and stays out of your way.
Well, this is about being circumspect and about your inner life. So it's really about this inner journey, and you don't want to talk about it.
My dad has a saying, don't tell your right hand what your left hand is doing, or something like that. And that's kind of the same thing, just it's more about being private even to yourself, I guess.
Yeah. One more little tiny piece of David Budbell. This one's called Bugs in a Bowl. And so he says, Han Shan, the great and crazy, wonder-filled Chinese poet of 1,000 years ago, said, we're just like bugs in a bowl, all day going around, never leaving the bowl. I say, that's right. Every day climbing up the steep sides, sliding back, over and over again, around and round, up and back down. Sit in the bottom of the bowl. Head in your hands, cry, moan, feel sorry for yourself, or look around. See your fellow bugs walk around. Say, hey, how you doing? Say, nice bowl.
What a beautiful bowl it is, though.
So, I have the need almost every day to read some poetry. If it shifts my awareness of what I'm doing and how I'm seeing the world. I remember one time, the first time I ever heard Mary Oliver's poem called Wild Geese, and it starts out with, you don't have to be good. And when I read that poem, I burst into tears. I just was blown away by how well she knew me. And then, this was at a bookstore. I was working at in Albuquerque in New Mexico. So then a customer came in that I had known very well, and I said, do you want to hear this poem that I just found? This is 1993, I think. And so I read her the poem, and she burst into tears, and then I burst into tears. And she said, I have to have that poem. I said, I do too. So we both bought copies of the book at the same time, and that kept carrying on. And I find that when I share those experiences that it makes me a better person. When I find a poem, like the bugs in a bowl, nice bowl. I mean, I just am grateful that people can recognize that there's something more to all of this insanity than just all this insanity. So I have a little story to tell you.
Okay.
This woman came, I have this book in front of me, in my hand right now, called Don't Sweat the Small Stuff. And this is from 1997. And we haven't had it in the store in 7 or 8 years. And this woman I know came in the store, and she seemed so remarkably different than the last time I'd seen her. I mean, a lot. And I said, what happened?
Did she cut her hair?
Yeah, she did look pretty good. But no, she did not cut her hair. She was reading this book, she told me. And I thought, I've never sat down and really read this book. It sold like hotcakes when it first came out, and it still sells like hotcakes. So I'm not actually going to read from the book. I'm going to read from the table of contents, which to me is like reading this really elegant poem. Okay, are you ready? And these are the chapter titles. So, 1, don't sweat the small stuff. 2, make peace with imperfection. 3, let go of the ideas that gentle, relaxed people can't be super achievers. 4, be aware of the snowball effect of your thinking. I don't know about you, but you know how you get that thought and it just gets going and going, you can't stop that thought?
I only have those thoughts. I have no other thoughts.
I mean, this book is just, I haven't even read the book. I just reading the table of contents made me happier and lighter. And I can see how my friend had changed because of this book and is really changing.
It seems like it should be like a manifesto or like guidelines of the way you go about life.
It is that. It is exactly that.
And the messed up part is these things are so simple. We've heard them before and we just, I don't know. We just don't listen.
It's like the left hand not listening to the right hand.
Exactly. In one ear and out the other.
Yeah, that's what it does. And then for some reason, for her, and this is what I was mentioning earlier about Moby Dick, there is a moment when the book really can speak to you, when you can hear what the book has to say. I couldn't hear Moby Dick several years ago when I was reading it, but for some reason, Moby Dick is really ringing true with me today. And for some reason, this book, Don't Sweat the Small Stuff, just the table of contents is rocking my world.
It definitely seems like it's a good book, and I think I'm probably going to try that one out. But I think that is a perfect book for us to close out on, because we've come to the end of our show. If you're just tuning in, that was Stanley Hatzell from Market Block Books. He comes every week to give us a good list of books that we should be reading.
Thanks so much, Stanley.
You're welcome.
And that concludes our show. We hope you've enjoyed this episode of Hudson Mohawk Magazine. I'm Mark Russo.
And I'm Tatiana Morani. Remember to tune back in tomorrow and every weekday at 7 a.m., 9 a.m., and 6 p.m. to get your daily dose of local news. You can also get your fix through our Hudson Mohawk Magazine podcast and our Facebook page.
As a reminder, WOOC 105.3 is produced by local volunteers. If you're interested in volunteering with WOOC, shoot us an email at info@mediasanctuary.org. Or just stop by one of our weekly meetings held on Monday nights at 7:07 p.m. right here at the Sanctuary for Independent Media. Until next time, folks, thanks for tuning in.